Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 21, the Tremont Street Subway Explosion. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to take a look at a tragic explosion that occurred in downtown Boston during the rush to build America's first subway. 10 people lost their lives, and many more were injured. For some Bostonians, the disaster confirmed their dark predictions about the subway project, which they believe was cursed from the beginning. But before we talk about the 1897 subway explosion, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is March 20th, and on March 20th, 1760, a fire broke out in a tavern in downtown Boston. It took over 10 hours to douse the flames, and before it was out, it burned buildings along Congress Street and King Street. It burned the shops and warehouses at Long Wharf and Lindell's Row. It even burned 10 ships anchored in the harbor. The Boston Evening Post said, "But the 20th of this March will be a day memorable for the most terrible fire that has happened in this town, or perhaps in any other part of North America, far exceeding that of October 2nd, 1711, till now termed the Great Fire." We now remember a conflagration from November 1872 as Boston's Great Fire, but that name was applied to the 1760 blaze for over a century. We'll have a link to that 1760 Boston Evening Post story in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/021.
On March 21st, 1776, Thomas Howe, the commanding general of the British forces who had just evacuated Boston, wrote to the Earl of Dartmouth, "My lord, it is with great regret I am obliged to inform your lordship that the enemy, by taking possession of and fortifying the commanding heights on Dorchester Neck in order to force the ships by their cannon to quit the harbor, has reduced me to the necessity either of exposing the army to the greatest distresses by remaining in Boston, or of withdrawing from it under such straitened circumstances. Since my determination, taken on the 7th, I have exerted every expedient to accomplish the arduous task which was executed on the 17th in the forenoon, without the least molestation from the rebels."
Wednesday is March 22nd. On March 22nd, 1638, a religious dissenter named Anne Hutchinson, her immediate family, and around 60 supporters were banished from Massachusetts Bay Colony. Among the group were John Wheelwright and his young daughter, Catherine. Catherine, of course, would grow up to be Catherine Nanny Naylor, and you can hear her story in episode 13 by going to hubhistory.com/013. Governor John Winthrop set the tone for the trial in his opening statement. "You have spoken diverse things, as we have been informed, very prejudicial to the honor of the churches and ministers thereof, and you have maintained a meeting and an assembly in your house that hath been condemned by the General Assembly as a thing not tolerable nor comely in the sight of God, nor fitting for your sex." After the sentence of banishment, Hutchinson's family would settle in the more tolerant colony of Rhode Island. A few years later, amid rumors that Puritan Massachusetts was going to take over Rhode Island, she moved the family to the Dutch-controlled wilderness that we now know as the Bronx. In the summer of 1643, a local conflict between the Dutch and a Native American tribe spilled onto the family's doorstep. Anne and at least 7 members of the family were killed, along with some servants, and 1 daughter was taken as a captive.
On March 23, 1797, Abigail Adams wrote to John with her plans for the spring season on the farm. "I have a kind man whose time will expire on the 30th. I have to pay for an ox bought for French $35. I have to hire day labor as an assistant to Brackett in plowing and tending manure. Billings is wholly occupied with the wall, and there he had better be kept. There is a piece against Deacon Bass to be made next, then against Jonathan Bass, and against Brackett, replacing old walls, etc. As usual, a multiplicity of business comes on, and many hands are wanted at once. That time which awaits for none may be lost. The seed is arrived, and I will make inquiry about the oats. I have endeavored to be as frugal as I could of the money remitted." By this time, Abigail had been managing the farm for many years, and it's worth noting that by 1797, she's no longer asking for permission. She's really just updating John on her plans. John always talked a good game about a life on the farm, but with his diplomatic and political careers, he had spent the better part of 2 decades away from their home in Quincy.
Friday is March 24th, and on March 24th, 1776, George Washington was taking stock of the assets left behind in Boston by the evacuating British a week before. He was particularly taken with one strong defensive position. "I have caused a large and strong work to be thrown up on Fort Hill, a post of great importance as it commands the whole harbor and, when fortified, if properly supported, will greatly annoy any fleet the enemy may send against the town, and render the landing of their troops exceedingly difficult, if not impracticable. This work is almost done, and in a little time will be complete." So where is this impressive prominence? The whole hill was leveled in the mid-19th century to make room for more development, a story that seems equally timely today.
In keeping with the revolutionary theme, Josiah Quincy Sr. was keeping a close eye on the British ships lingering in Boston Harbor on March 25, 1776. In a letter to George Washington, he gave an hour-by-hour account of how many ships were coming and going, and especially their signal flags. For example, 10 o'clock. "The same signal is now flying at the Admiral's maintop masthead as was hoisted yesterday morning. Scarce hoisted, before it was lowered again, and in about half an hour a blue flag is flying at mizzentop masthead, and a pendant at his mizzen peak." 11 o'clock. "The signals are changed for a red ensign hoisted just under his mizzen yard. A signal is just now hoisted upon the top of the lighthouse for vessels in the offing, and immediately followed by a blue, broad pendant from the middle of the tower. In less than 10 minutes, the signal first mentioned, a pendant, is flying from his maintop masthead." 12 o'clock. "A red ensign is now flying at his mizzentop masthead, a blue ensign at his starboard mizzen shrouds, and a pendant thrown out between, by hand, and immediately taken in again." We'll have a link to the complete blow-by-blow in the show notes this week at hubhistory.com/021.
Finally, Sunday is March 26th. On March 26th, 1631, two Pawtucket leaders came to Boston to lodge a complaint with the governor. Montawampate and his brother Wanahakwaham were known to the colonists as Sagamore James and Sagamore John. They controlled a swath of the North Shore along today's Route 1, Saugus, Lynn, Reading, and more. In early 1631, a settler named Watts had stolen 20 beaver pelts from them, so they came to the governor for help. Governor Winthrop gave them a letter of introduction to an attorney in London, and it's possible that Montawampate traveled to England to collect on the debt. In the end, it wouldn't help. By 1633, both brothers and most of their tribe had died of smallpox. For more on smallpox, listen to our episode on inoculation, which is still our most popular show. We'll link back to it in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/021.
Now, let's turn to our main event. March 4th, 1897 was a typical winter day in Boston. It was cold and clear, but snow-free for the moment. There was an undercurrent of excitement as Boston waited for news from Washington. It was inauguration day, and our 25th president, William McKinley, was about to take the oath of office for his first term. Then, as now, the corner of Tremont Street and Boylston was one of the busiest in town, with pedestrians, carriages, and electric and horse-drawn streetcars headed in every direction. It was so busy that the city was at work building the nation's first subway underfoot to try to alleviate some of the chronic congestion. At about 11:45 a.m., three streetcars were passing the corner. A Huntington Avenue car headed north, a Back Bay car headed south, and a Mount Auburn car headed east toward Washington Street. The Mount Auburn car had to turn right from Tremont onto Boylston, just as the Green Line turns right on its way out of Boylston Street Station on the way to Arlington today. As the car made its turn, its wheels screeched and sparked. Suddenly, the ground erupted in a giant explosion. Soil, wood beams, and iron tracks were thrown into the air. Flames shot up higher than the rooftops, and even the streetcars were thrown 10 feet into the air. According to the next morning's Globe, "They shot off the rails and skyward, a distance varying 4 to 10 feet. They descended, twisted, and breaking iron flames and grinding wood into powder. The passengers within, happy, jovial on inauguration day, not suspecting a danger a moment before, found themselves then with bleeding faces and broken limbs, imprisoned under a mass of wreckage which had caught fire. The breathless body of a conductor lay in plain sight just beyond the tangle. A Back Bay car was hoisted highest in the air. Guilford D. Bigelow, the conductor, was killed outright, and Benjamin R. Sargent, the driver, was injured fatally, it is believed by the doctors who attended him. The two horses that furnished the motive power were mangled beneath an electric, which descended upon them with its great weight. A Mount Auburn car, inbound, took a toss, was enwrapped in flames, and was soon in ashes. Paul Hackett, the conductor, suffered two broken legs. A Reservoir car lost all its windows and was a sorry-looking sight, although it stuck to the track. Six people were killed almost immediately, and hundreds of bystanders rushed to pull the injured from the wreckage as flames continued to shoot from the ground and the live wires from the streetcars sparked and snapped. We'll post pictures in the show notes to give you a sense of the scale of destruction. Streetcars and construction timbers were smashed to toothpicks. Horses were crushed under streetcars or blown free and disemboweled. Windows shattered for blocks around. Clocks stopped at 11:47 sharp. While a barber was giving a haircut on the second floor of a nearby building, he was blown across the room and injured by flying glass. The fire and police departments responded quickly and were able to shut the gas and electricity off and bring the blaze under control. As the smoke cleared, survivors quickly realized that there had been a massive gas explosion and that it had something to do with the construction of the subway. To understand what happened that morning and why it shook the collective Boston psyche, it's important to understand the fraught relationship the city had with the new subway being built beneath their feet.
Boston in the late 19th century was something of a boom town. The population had been swelled by immigration from Ireland, and the bounds of the city were being expanded by both filling in the tide flats along the Back Bay and the waterfront, and by annexing the surrounding towns of Roxbury, Dorchester, Brighton, Charlestown, and West Roxbury. Railroads had opened up commerce with areas not connected by water, and our factories, merchants, and financial services were booming. This rapid growth and economic success overwhelmed the city's street grid, which was still a relic of the 1600s in many ways. While some residents of Boston still lived within walking distance of their jobs, the new railways offered commuted rates for day passengers without baggage, allowing workers to begin commuting from the suburbs. Private carriages, hackney cabs, and heavy wagons were all pulled by horses. By 1888, the West End Street Railway Company was operating thousands of streetcars, some drawn by horses, and others propelled by electric motors powered by overhead wires. While the streetcars enabled people to get around, they did little to alleviate congestion, as they ran on the already crowded streets. The section of Tremont Street between Scolly Square and Boylston Street was pure havoc. It carried shoppers to and from the main shopping districts, as well as office workers and government officials headed to Beacon Hill. By the 1880s, streetcars would pack Tremont Street end to end at rush hour, and people said that one could walk from Tremont Temple to the Masonic Temple on their roofs, without ever setting foot on the ground. The city was desperate to find ways to get some of this traffic off the streets, and was considering two competing proposals. One was the brainchild of Josiah V. Meigs of Lowell. It was known as the Meigs Elevated Railway, and it would have been a steam-powered monorail running on an elevated track.
What's it called? Monorail! Once again!
Meigs was all in on this idea, going as far as building a large test track in East Cambridge, where steam locomotives ran on a 22-inch track, 18 feet above the ground. City and state officials were whisked on an exciting ride of 20 miles an hour or more, around curves and up and down grades. We'll have a link in this week's show notes to pictures of the test track and to a Globe editorial arguing in favor of the elevated railway. It was a strong contender to be Boston's mass transit upgrade, but nature got in the way. In March of 1888, a terrible storm swept through Boston. Known as the Snow Hurricane, it dumped up to 60 inches of snow on the region and killed over 400 people. Cities were paralyzed for weeks as carts, streetcars, and even railroads were immobilized while the snow was being cleared.
The Snow Hurricane was a tipping point in the selection of the competing transit proposal. A subway. The idea of running an underground railroad wasn't entirely new. London had steam trains running underground since 1863, and was in the process of constructing an electrified subway that would open in 1890. Boston decided to follow suit, building the first section of the Tremont Street subway in the 1890s. The decision to create a subway was not without controversy. In 1894, a citywide proposal to build the subway passed by a mere 1,200 votes. At the time, the underground world was viewed with a great deal of suspicion. That's where rats and snakes came from, and where sewage and dead bodies went to. It was the realm of the devil, of unknown germs and evil spirits. As Charles Bond put it, the underground was seen as the realm of Lucifer himself, inhabited by lost souls, moldering corpses, strange forms of animal life, and noxious vapors. A newly formed anti-subway league gathered signatures on petitions against the subway and planted editorials in the Boston Post with titles like, "Hideous germs lurk in the underground air." They claimed that there was a new strain of subway microbes that were poised to strike subway commuters. They even published an artist rendition of these microbes, and you can bet we'll have a copy of it in this week's show notes. After the groundbreaking ceremony for the subway in March of 1895, the Boston Daily Advertiser claimed that the excavated dirt was killing the trees in the Boston Public Garden. They said, "Wherever the earth dredged up from the subway cribs has been spread over the ground, the trees have been sickened. Some of them have died. Why should this foul, poisonous sod be laid out in the city's parks to perfume the neighborhood and spread disease germs over the surrounding regions?"
The process of building the original subway tunnel was, in many ways, simpler than you're probably imagining. It used a technique called cut and cover, which basically means just digging a trench large enough for the tracks, putting a roof over it, and then adding the soil back on top. The era of deep tunnel boring machines was still well in the future. The first stretch of tunnel would reach from an underground turnaround at Park Street, along Tremont Street, under the corner of the Common, and then exit through a portal onto the public garden. Construction of this first tunnel hadn't progressed very far when workers made a gory discovery. As they dug along the edge of Boston Common, they began unearthing human bones. Planners had worried that the tunnel might run into a few unmarked graves near the edges of Central Burying Ground, but a month after the groundbreaking, workers were finding more bones than expected. In the end, over 900 bodies were exhumed from the Common and the margins of Central Burying Ground, from unmarked graves that may have included British soldiers who had occupied the Common during the opening months of the Revolution. In the end, all the bodies were buried in a communal grave at Central Burying Ground, which is today marked with a single stone that says, "Here were reinterred the remains of persons found under the Boylston Street Mall during the digging of the subway, 1895. We'll have a picture of the stone in this week's show notes.
With those grave discoveries fresh in Boston's memories, there is a strong undertone of anti-subway sentiment when people began reporting gas leaks along Boylston Street in December of 1896. The Boston Gas Light Company played a cat-and-mouse game for the next 3 months, fixing leaks as quickly as they could be located. There were over 2,000 reported leaks between December of 1896 and March of 1897. Construction work on the subway could only be carried out at night, so the busy streets could be open to traffic during the day. At about 3 a.m. on March 4th, 1897, a crew under James Groke was backfilling soil over the new tunnel at the corner of Tremont and Boylston. They lifted a section of the wooden decking that served as a temporary roadway, dumped 2 cartloads of soil into the trench, and tightly packed the soil with iron tampers. In the trench with them were pipes carrying water, sewage, electric cables, and natural gas. By 7 in the morning, the soil was packed, the decking was back in place, and traffic was beginning to pick up on Tremont Street. As March 4th progressed, businesses along Boylston Street were having trouble with their gas appliances. The smell of gas had been getting worse over time. It had recently been blamed for the death of a cat in the basement of a health food store along Tremont, and sometimes the smell got so bad that people in apartments along Tremont had to abandon their homes until it cleared up. Each time, the gas company would make repairs, but warned customers that the smell was likely to come back, blaming the subway work. On this morning, it was worse than ever before. A policeman on patrol tried to find the source, searching near the Masonic Temple on Washington Street. two dentists in different offices on Boylston complained that they didn't have enough gas pressure to sterilize their instruments. The gas company was called, but they also searched along Washington Street, rather than at the corner of Boylston and Tremont.
Natural gas is methane, which is lighter than air. In many cases, a leak will simply result in the gas dissipating harmlessly into the atmosphere. However, when construction caused the large leak on March 4, 1897, the gas became trapped in the construction space under the temporary wooden decking at the corner of Tremont and Boylston. As that Mount Auburn trolley rounded the corner onto Boylston Street, its screeching wheels caused a spark, the spark met that pocket of gas, and the world erupted into flame. As the smoke cleared, six people lay dead. George Bigelow, conductor of the Back Bay trolley, was killed as his streetcar was blasted to pieces. Reverend W.A. Start, the bursar at Tufts College, was walking down the sidewalk in front of the Hotel Pelham and was killed by the initial blast. William Vinnell, private secretary to a well-known Boston banker, was riding in a coupe carriage driven by Benjamin Downing. Both men were killed as the carriage was destroyed. Delano Sibley, a cab driver, happened to be passing the scene and was killed by the blast. And Amelia M. Bates, a 70-year-old woman, was riding in a private carriage with her sister. She suffered a terrible death as she was trapped inside the carriage as it burned, while her sister watched helplessly. Dozens were injured, and four more would die in the coming days. In the pictures we'll post in the show notes, you'll see the surprising scale of the destruction. Timbers and rails were tangled like pickup sticks. Dead horses lay in the streets. Trolleys were blown to pieces, and a large crater stood in the middle of the street. Cleanup had to begin immediately. By summer, test cars were running through the subway tunnel, and on September 1, 1897, America's first subway officially opened. The tunnels were well lit, and the stations were brightly whitewashed, allaying the fears of the Anti-Subway League.
The subway project was quickly put back on track, but the same couldn't be said for the victims of the explosion. Many suffered terrible injuries and would try to sue to recover their medical bills and damages. However, the tangled web of government and private contractors involved in constructing the subway made this a very difficult prospect. Wolf Copeland, who had been a 15-year-old shoeshine boy at the time of the explosion, suffered serious cuts, a head injury, and permanently lost the hearing in his right ear. He quickly filed a lawsuit against the City of Boston, the Metropolitan Construction Company, the West End Street Railway Company, the Boston Gaslight Company, the Bay State Gas Company, the Edison Illuminating Company, and the Boston Electric Light Company. After only 7 hours of deliberation, a jury awarded him a $3,000 judgment against the city, the West End Street Railway Company, and the Boston Gaslight Company. However, almost 4 years later, his victory was still tied up in appeals at the end of the year 1900. All that sounds eerily similar to the gas explosion we are personally acquainted with. In 2009, a house exploded near our home in Reedville. A subcontractor was excavating to replace water mains, but they damaged a gas main and the house's basement quickly filled with gas. Luckily, nobody was home because the house exploded moments later, leveling that house and damaging many around it. As the insurance companies tried to determine culpability, the City Water and Sewer Department, the gas company, a contractor, the subcontractor, and the DigSafe service became tangled in a web of lawsuits. The couple rented a home while also paying a mortgage on a hole in the ground. Their case was not resolved until 2015, much like poor Wolf Copeland.
If anyone wants to find out more about the 1897 Tremont Street explosion, you can head over to this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/021. We'll have a photo gallery showing the destruction caused by the explosion. We'll also have a contemporary news report and a side-by-side photo comparison showing the explosion site in 1897 and 2014. We'll have links to the book A City So Grand by Stephen Puleo, which is a great reference for anything that happened in Boston in the 19th century. And to the book The Race Underground by Doug Most, which is about the competition between Boston and New York to build the first subway in the U.S. You can also see links to the news coverage of the 2009 gas explosion in our neighborhood. Before we go, I'd also like to say hi to a group of architectural historians who listen to the show. I met one of them at history camp yesterday. Her name might have been Hillary? Drop us a line to remind us who you are.
Even before history camp, we'd noticed an influx of new listeners in the last few weeks. Hi! If you're new to the show, explore the archives, and we'd love it if you could leave us a review on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. We're still trying to get over the minimum number of iTunes reviews for the reviews to be publicly available, and that would be a great way to help us spread the word about the show. We've also decided to have a contest to give away a Back Bay deconstructed walking tour. It focuses on the process of filling in the Back Bay salt marsh and building today's neighborhood. If you like us on Facebook between now and March 31st, you'll be entered in a raffle to win a tour for up to 12 people, and we'll announce the winner on our April 2nd show. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at Hub History on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. And while you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show we're calling Boston and the American Revolution, our very first interview show with author Brooke Barbier.